welcome back to another episode of PCL OTR. And this is a big one, too. It's titled The Great Wave. I am not alone here to talk about this big episode. I've also got Jake from Pop Culture Leftovers. Welcome, Jake.
Hey, thanks. What's up, guys?
And we have Mr. Joe Stark from Starkcast Podcast. Welcome, Joe.
Hey, stoked to be here.
And Billy Blinks from The Reality Guys on YouTube. Welcome, Billy.
Thanks, guys. Excited for episode 4.
I am too, man. Oh my gosh. When I saw the title, when it popped up, The Great Wave, I was like, holy shit. Are we there? Is this happening now?
Time jump.
I think, you know, it's like one of those things, like last episode I brought up, oh, we're probably going to be seeing like, you know, the fall of Numenor episode, season 3 or season 4. I feel like we're getting it much sooner after this one. They're definitely compressing the timelines here. Wouldn't you agree? Or am I not thinking correctly?
No, dude, they are absolutely compressing the timeline on this. And there's a part of me that wouldn't even be surprised if we had the actual big wave by the end of the season.
I could see it too. I guess I'm a little bit on the other side of it. I think it really more so is the foreshadowing of it being out. I think it, like you had said last week, Brian, I'm leaning more towards if we're doing the 5-season run, maybe season 4. What it does do, though, it does again set the stakes and it keeps the momentum and it shows how serious and how sudden and urgent things are now. And I think this episode did a really good job of keeping the momentum going while moving more things into place. But I do like that it feels like the things that are happening now do actually have an effect on the end game. And we're not meandering until we get a big event like that.
I don't know, man. I guess I'm 50-50 on this one. Like, yes, it could go. I think the furthest it could go is probably into season 2, but I feel like maybe they want to wrap this season up with the fall of Numenor. And I feel like they've really compressed the timelines. And I felt like as soon as they introduce Isildur into this series and following him, he's a man. So it's not like he has, even though he's one of the Dunedain, he doesn't have like the long life of like an elf or something like that. So I was thinking, they might have compressed like a lot of history here. So I don't know, Billy. We'll see.
Yeah, I like that it's up for debate.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it could be a season 2 thing, because just thinking of some of the things from the books that are kind of key moments that would still need to happen, that's a lot to happen in just 4 more episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, very true. We'll see. I mean, it's up to the showrunners, though. We'll see what happens. I do think there was a lot more things in this episode that came out of the mouth of Halbrand that lead me to believe that this dude is Sauron. I'm telling you, and I can't wait to talk about that when we get into the Galadriel storyline. But I think more things that Halbrand is saying really kind of makes me think that he is Sauron. And, you know, we had a whole discussion on all the things in episode 3 Adar that led me to believe that Halbrand is Sauron. I'm still 100%. Planting that flag. Halbrand is Sauron. If you want to hear like what we talked about in the previous episode and what made me believe that, yeah, just go back and listen to that episode. But I feel like there's even more proof and evidence of just things that he said in this episode that lead me to believe that, yeah, this guy is like the big bad. This guy is Sauron. So, yeah. Numenoreans are just, they continue to piss off the Valar in this episode. Like, it is just, I don't know. It just blows me away. I wish we could see, like, the reaction of the Valar while all this kind of stuff is going on. Like,
split screen action.
I'm pretty sure right now, Brian, they're filling up the bathtub. That's their reaction.
I'm picturing that meme with the guy with his hands on his hips shaking his head.
they're up there and they're looking down and like, oh my God, look at that mob. Oh, can you hear what they're saying? Oh my God. No, I mean, oh my us. I cannot believe that. Oh my God. After all that we've given them, you know, but Yeah, man, there's a wave coming. I wish I was, part of me was hoping that this episode would end with Soundgarden's My Wave. I would, like, that would have been so badass. But we have a lot to talk about on this episode. It was directed by Wayne Chi Yip. And, a couple things that I did want to point out here real quick, that every time I watch and I see Durin, I see just Zach Galifianakis.
I have not seen it until you say it, but yeah, I know what you mean.
And then if you look at Farazan, I just see Bill Hader as like one of his characters. It just
is that I can definitely see.
That's really funny.
But man, guys, I really just want to jump into this episode and break it down with you. First, let me ask this. Were you guys happy with the episode? Was this a good episode? Joe, what did you think about The Great Wave?
This show just keeps getting better and better, because this episode has been my favorite so far. Just in general, this episode really blew me away. It had lots of really amazing action in it, like action scenes that, you know, really make you jump up and like, whoa, holy shit, I can't believe I just saw that on the screen, and this is in a television show. But then also this episode had so much heart in it. I watched this one twice. In the second time, like it made me tear up even harder than the first one. Like, there was so much heart in this episode of television that so far this is my favorite.
Jake.
This is probably my least favorite episode so far. I did like it quite a lot. I'm saying it's my least is by no means I didn't like it. But yeah, to me, it felt like a getting all the pieces in place episode. I did enjoy the ending to this episode more than any of the other episodes. It was a nice feel good ending that still got me excited for the next episode. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe even though the Nori stuff was the worst part of last week, I think I missed it a little bit here. I would have liked to have seen a little bit of a flash to them. And yeah, I don't know. This just felt like the middle of a movie where you're waiting for that next big act to me.
Interesting. Okay. Billy, what'd you think?
I was a huge fan of the episode. Leaning more towards what Joe was saying, obviously, we always talk about every week about the visuals. The visuals are always stunning. The acting has improved, I think, every week. For me, though, what really hit me home is this was one of the first times really that I felt like, in a way, I was watching a Jackson film. I hearkened to the scene with Elrond and Durin, and when Elrond's talking about his father, mm-hmm. and wanting to live up to the expectations of his father. Mm-hmm. And I know we can all relate to that, whether it's a parent or a loved one or a friend, whatever, that feeling of wanting to live up and make them proud. And imagine Elrond, who's father was so great, like he said, he literally went to the Undying Lands and convinced the gods to go to war, and then was made a star. I mean, and it was so human, and you could see Durin's face, and it's like, that's what my favorite part about fantasy is, where you can find the human elements in it, and not like the race human, but like us as people. And that's, so this, it hit me, and we watched, like I said, on my rewatches, it hit me as well. So I was a huge fan. I leave this episode feeling great.
Yeah, this is my I think it's tied for my second favorite episode. My first my favorite was definitely the last one, but I think I got this tied with episode two. And I really did enjoy a lot of what was kind of showcased in this episode. Let's jump into the Arendir story. So Arendir, last time we saw him, he was, you know, being taken to Adar, and we get our first look at Adar, and Adar, before he has any conversation with Arendir, is looking after one of the orcs that Arendir attacked, and he has to perform a mercy killing on the orc. And I don't know if you guys noticed this, but, you know, for such, you know, evil creatures that come from such darkness, and Adar, who's supposed to be, you know, one of our main villains here that we've seen this season, he looks visibly sad having to do this, having to perform this mercy killing. And it goes back to, like, you know, some of the things that we talked about last episode with him being called father. He's acting as if he is a father to this orc, that, you know, and he's going to be the one that has to put this orc out of his mercy. And, you know, for such evil creatures, I just did kind of notice that he did have a lot of, like, sympathy for.
Absolutely. Yeah. I picked up on that, too. I think he even rolled a tear. And it made me think of the last episode when Arondir had to cut down that tree. And before he did it, he laid his hand upon it,
mm-hmm.
and spoke softly, and then swung his blade. And it was it just mirrored that. And to see an elf, the thought of an elf doing that with a tree is, you know, you don't bat an eye. You're like, yeah, that sounds right, with a sylvan elf doing that. And to now see this some sort of dark, fallen, twisted elf creature that has such sympathy for beings of just pure evil, that, I mean, it doesn't bode well for who this guy is.
I read, after we recorded last episode, I read that the actor that plays Arondir improvised that moment where he put his hand on the tree, and they actually wrote the line of dialogue after the fact for him to say.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. So Adar starts to talk to Arondir, and he asks where he was born, and he gives him the location, and Adar asks, you know, is that near the river? And he's like, you know, he talks about how when he was young, he went by the river there, and he remembers that it was covered with sage blossoms. And I'm thinking to myself, like, this guy seems to have, you know, seems like he's been around some of these areas that elves inhabit. This guy has to be like a dark elf. This guy has to be a fallen elf. It feels like he has, you know, unless he's just a very well-traveled, well-spoken orc, which I don't believe it's the case. He looks too elvish. I think he is a very ancient and now a dark elf that has been corrupted by Morgoth.
Yeah, I'm thinking that he's been around since the First Age, and he fought in that first war with Morgoth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think at this point he's gone rogue for Morgoth, or are they still working together?
I think right now he believes that, you know, Sauron is missing, so he's kind of taken up kind of like that leadership role. And he's, you know, he's doing his part to perform this contingency plan that we know about of constructing Mordor. But first things first, they have to find that sword, which we'll get into later. So I think that he's 100% still on the side of Morgoth and like, you know, the construction of Mordor.
I agree. I think we're going to come to find out, and it seems that there's going to be some sort of backstory with this elf, whether he became disenfranchised by the elves or he was looking into further power or something that they didn't agree with, and he's becomes like able to sympathize with the Morgoth side and that type of sympathies, and maybe the necromancy and the stuff that we've talked about over the first three episodes in our coverage. So it definitely feels like there is more to the story, and they're definitely lying the kind of groundwork for him to be maybe a semi-sympathetic character.
I think I agree with that. I a lot of people are saying, like, oh, this is Sauron. I don't believe that he is Sauron. I think he's something closer to like a Gollum. And what I mean by that is someone that's been tortured and has been corrupted. Because Gollum started off as Sméagol and, you know, became corrupted and evil. And I think that this guy has been tortured by Morgoth and then, you know, kind of like broken down like some people do when they join a cult. And so that's I do think that he was the first elf that was used to create the orcs, and that's why they call him father. He's been around for a very long time. So I compare him more to Gollum than I would Sauron at this point.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, that he's far closer to that, because he's clearly somebody who's been deceived as well, because he tells Arondir that eventually he sees – he made it sound like he's chasing godhood. And well, that's not something that's really possible. And so clearly he's been deceived, whether it's by Sauron or Morgoth, but he's doing what he's doing thinking that he's going to be made a god. And it's like, no, probably not.
Well, he tells Arondir, he's like, you've been told many lies. And then he speaks about him, like you said, Joe, not being a god, not yet. And I think this is another misdirection of him being like this power hungry Sauron. But I also think that with him saying you've been told many lies, he's been on the side that Arondir's been on before, because I believe he was an elf. And so he knows kind of like, you know, the way he was raised, he knows what it's like to be an elf. And he's telling him, you know, you've heard all these lies. Again, sounding like, you know, like a cultist, like now his eyes are open.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the one that knows what the real score is.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just kind of thinking as you were saying that, Bri, too, another motivation could be like maybe he was left for dead, abandoned by the elves. I could totally see that being something. And also another thing could be really interesting is I've seen a lot of the, you know, discourse, you know, even people from last week when they saw the kind of ending and going through theorizing. I didn't see anyone say this, but I would be really cool if this guy was maybe this guy is like a rival to Sauron, like someone who wants to be the successor, and like that could be really interesting as well, if it's not just this clear, oh, we're all behind Sauron, and it could maybe be his own kind of claim to the throne, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely could be this guy's motive at this point, since Sauron is kind of like, I feel like Sauron's in hiding right now, so that definitely could be one of his motives at this point. We wondered, how in the world is Arondir going to get out of like this prison camp? And it's as easy as Adar letting him go and sending a message to the men in the watchtower of the Southlands. And that makes sense. Like I felt like all hope was lost. Like, how is he going to get out of here? We saw how it ended last week so tragically with the death of the Watchwarden and Mador, and, you know, even human lives were lost, you know, so it kind of made sense that the only way to kind of get our hero out of this was to let him go and have him send a message to the men in the Southland, the men of the Southlands.
Yeah, it would have been super silly for him to fight his way out after what we saw last episode. So yeah, it was really good writing here.
I thought it was super badass. Honestly, I thought it was really cool and really confident and menacing of the character. Like, I'll let you go. Not worried about it. Go send a message.
Right.
It's so sinister. It's awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
And I loved that he found that like spearhead or whatever that thing was on the ground. And he was totally ready to take this guy out, knowing that he's not going to survive it. And as soon as he gets that, you know, the offer to take a message, he relaxes. And you're right, though, dude. It was absolutely hopeless last week. How was he going to get out of there? It's like, is he going to be here all season?
Yeah. I know. It's like, could we wait for somebody to come and rescue him? And yeah, not happening. This makes sense. We jump to the Southlands. People are starving. They're low on rations, and you know they're living day to day. And what they had, like a total of like 10 potatoes. It's like, oh my God, these people are hurting for some fucking food. And Theo says, hey, you know, we can go into the town during the day when the orcs are fewer and scrounge up more food. Bronwyn is like, no, you're not going. That's not happening. And, you know what? Theo hasn't really been listening to anybody but Theo since we've met him. And Theo and his buddy go off anyway. And yeah, they get to the old town. Every living thing in the town is dead. We see sheep slaughtered, the cow decapitated. every living thing is dead. So it's like they're making a run for like grain and whatever other things they can get. But I mean, it just looked like the orcs just went in there and just killed everything. They're like, yeah, if you come back, you're not getting cows. You're not getting sheep. They've killed them all. And they didn't even look like they had eaten from them. It just looked like they had slaughtered them.
Yeah, they just killed them and left them right where they died.
I felt like they had enough food. Like, they cut back, and, like, Roy is, like, pushing that wheelbarrow. They've got a lot of food, grain just stacked up in the wheelbarrow. I'm thinking, you're good to go. Theo's like, no, I'm going to go into the tavern for more. And so,
scrape a little bit more grain off the floor. That'll put us over the top.
So, yeah, he goes into the tavern. He's there. He, unbeknownst to him, there is an orc in there. Orc starts to you know, battle with him, and Theo goes to pull out the sword. Did it start to pull the blood again? Did it start to pull blood, or did it just fucking, like, ignite like it was, like, Kylo Ren's lightsaber?
I think it pulled some blood.
Yeah. Like, in the wrist. I didn't see the blood. I just saw, like, the fog swirling around in the ignition.
It felt like the hilt almost, like, cut him and, like, took some blood, right? I don't know.
He had to pull up his sleeve beforehand. And so I don't know if it did draw a trickle of blood down from that mark that's on his forearm. It was cool that it I think it's going to be a magic lightsaber type sword going forward. That's pretty wild.
I love the special effects that they used on the sword, kind of like reforming itself. Fantastic. It looks great. Like, this is, you can definitely tell, like, the FX budget was not spared here. It looks really good.
Really? Yeah, it looked fucking great. I cracked up when his buddy Rowan just got the hell out of Dodge immediately. Like, one cloud went over, and Rowan's like, oh, I'm out.
he looked like one of, like, the cousins from Ozark, that friend took off. Like, it didn't even look like they were from the same village.
That's excellent. I know, he hears like a bang in there in like the one cloud, and he's like, later, buddy.
I have another question, you know, and I'm not going to call this a plot hole. I'm being a little facetious here, but, you know, this whole part about them needing a lot of food to survive. We do have our elf friend here. Can he not go get some Lembas bread? Can he not just help the village out, go get a couple of loaves? We'll all be okay.
He hadn't showed up yet at this point.
Yeah, where is he? Like, he's in captivity. He's been taken as a prisoner of war.
No, I just even mean in general, he's got his sweet girlfriend that he's pining over and stuff. He could definitely have been helping out this poor village over time with some of that sweet Lembas bread.
He hasn't been there since they had to relocate to the Watchtower, Billy.
I know. I'm just having a little fun with it, thinking of this. It's like, made me think about, like, man, the food thing has always been like an issue in Lord of the Rings, and always was like a cool thing that I thought Tolkien thought of by having the Lembas bread. Kind of took a lot of that question out for, especially even like later on when you talk about like Sam and Frodo and that type of stuff. So that's so much funny.
When was Lembas bread?
Exactly.
Let's keep dissecting the joke.
Oh, somebody's got some. Someone will know the first time the Lembas bread was baked in Tolkien's lore.
That is,
they're condensing time. They've already got Lembas bread.
This is 3 minutes of my life I will never get back. So this orc is aware that he has the sword, and yes, this is what they've been looking for. This is what they've been looking for. This is what Adar has had them looking for. We talked about it last week. We were like, you know, yes, they're digging out these tunnels and trenches, and they're slowly making their way, but they did say that they were looking for something as well. That's what the Watch Warden told Arendir, is that they're also looking for something. It's something that he picked up on, and they found it. So these orcs, the one orc sees it, yells, I found it, and now it's like a race to find Theo. These orcs are looking for Theo. Theo hides in a well, and I thought it was a very cool shot of like when they were looking up, Theo's down at the bottom of the well, and the shot looking up, and you can see the orc kind of like hovering over the well, and I was very nervous for Theo here. I didn't feel like he was going to die, but I did feel like there was a good chance that they could catch him, and maybe take the sword away from him.
Yeah, it felt like a high stakes moment. It was making my pulse race also. And yeah, I thought that well looked great. All the moss on the stones and everything. And you know, there was like a big root growing in there. And then when he pops out also, it reminded me of like an excellent speed run through Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah.
Like just so good at avoiding detection.
So he stays in there for probably hours until, like, you know, he thinks things have died down. He gets out of the well, tries to run away, and thinks, I mean, he's got this confident smile on his face. He's like, I've made it, and turns a corner, and boom, there's an orc, grabs him. And now this orc is getting ready to kill him, and who shows up? Aaron Deere shows up.
Armed to the teeth.
Yeah.
and good thing too. How cool is that sword he was carrying?
Oh, it was dope. Yeah, I dug it. So Aaron Deere's showing up because he has no idea that the town's been evacuated. So he's going back to make sure that Bronwyn and Theo and the people of the town are safe, correct?
That was my thought.
Yeah,
is that he must have been released somewhere near there to where he stopped and rearmed himself and then immediately went to that town.
Yeah. As they're running away from the orcs and the music starts to play and we're watching them being chased through like the forest, it was very reminiscent of the Fellowship of the Rings for me at the very end of that movie where they're running from the Uruk-hai and it felt very much like that moment here to me. Like the music running from all the orcs and like, I guess.
I agree. Especially the way the arrows were fired and the slow motion camera usage. Yeah. Also very similar to how they filmed it in Fellowship. I had that same feeling.
Yeah.
It's that sense of overwhelming chaos. You as a sense almost to start to drown it out. There's just too much going on and it's kind of the sense of their adrenaline and it just really like they may not actually be hearing all the chaos around them. They're just so singularly focused in escaping. And again, just really awesome effect of by taking away the sound and actually almost like emphasized it. It was really cool.
Oh, that sequence was amazing. I loved it. It almost was like he heard that arrow coming in and he shoves Theo forward and then catches the arrow and spins and knocks it himself and fires it right back at the orc archer that was closest. It's just so cool. It is a very good use of slow motion. And also, I love the way that the light was slowly changing throughout that entire shot. From the beginning, when he catches Theo in the village, it's still dark. And as they're running through the woods, it's getting lighter and lighter and lighter.
I'm glad that they have the luxury of the sun against these orcs, because I really feel like if this was like Uruk-hai chasing after them, it would have been like game over. But thank goodness we're not at Uruk-hai yet and they can still get away in that clearing where the sun was out.
I'm going to tell you what, I think going into this series and at least after the first two episodes we reviewed on the premiere, I thought Aaron Deere was going to be the character I was least interested in. And I got to say, four episodes in, I'm really, really intrigued by where his character arc is going. I think that interaction that he had in the camps about, you know, you've been told many lies. I think he's really going, we're going to see kind of a little bit of a disillusionment with him and the elves and maybe everything he thought he grew up on not being exactly what he thought. And I'm super intrigued. And it's crazy how quickly that turned for me in four episodes.
I mean, well, look at Galadriel. She's kind of like on her own doing, you know, things without the help of Gil-galad. And, you know, she's like one elf trying to do what she feels like is the right thing. Yes, there is a vow to her brother, but I mean, and that's pushing her, but I think her eyes are pretty damn open to like what's going on here. And I think that's the kind of character arc we need from Aaron Deere. By the time he gets to hopefully meet up with Galadriel, I think these two will be able to really connect. Hopefully. I'm dying to see these two characters meet.
Yeah, meeting Galadriel could be the final push to get him there also, and you know, as well.
And it's like, you know, if you think about like how long it took characters to meet in Game of Thrones, I mean, It could be the same way here. We might be thinking, oh, you know, they're going to meet by the end of the season. We don't know. This might be a season three thing before these two even meet. We just do not know. Middle Earth is big.
That's a great point. It was like four seasons until Khaleesi met anybody.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. We just don't know.
I wonder if the people at the Watchtower are going to be a little friendlier to Arondir now that he's rescued Theo, and, you know, is he going to, are they still going to be so outrightly hostile towards him like they were in that first episode?
I would guess not. I think at this point they would probably know that they need his help and his service. They understand the threat a little bit more. They can't afford to have the attitudes they had.
They need somebody on their side that can catch arrows in midair.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's just the way that they, you know, they called him knife ears. And it's like, I don't know if you can change just years of like hatred like that overnight. So we'll see how they react to Arondir.
I could almost like kind of agree with Brian there. Like, there could be a scenario where some of them are blaming the elves for this somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, this is all your fault. You brought them here. Something like that. So, back at the Watchtower, Arondir arrives, tells Bronwyn he was given a message from Adar, that the men forsake the lands and give fealty to him. And if they refuse, they die. So, do you think that once this message is given, some of these men will swear their loyalty and allegiance to Adar? I think it's definitely going to cause some stir among the men. And I feel like we might see some of these men just exactly do what Adar wants. I don't know if I see all of them basically, you know, wanting to fight against this. We know of at least one man who's going to give fealty to Adar.
Right. Gary knows all the bedtime stories and everything.
Yeah, that guy just went right for it. No beating around the bush, name dropping. But I think you're right, Brian. It could be a combination of some straight walkouts or maybe this growing dissension within as well.
Yeah.
I like the idea that it's a large amount of them, and then Arondir's with them, and then he's remembering the words of the Watchwarden. You know, actually seeing these people actively choose fucking evil again,
right
in front of him. And then maybe Bronwyn has to leave and... Ooh, yeah, I like it that it's actually a relatively small amount that don't want to.
Theo talks to the old man, that old man that we've seen before in the town. He's he throws him some alcohol, right? And he says he deserves it for taking the hilt, and then shows him his mark on his arm, and Theo has that same mark. And then he talks about the sword and says, it's no sword. It is a power fashioned for our ancestors by his master's own hand. A beautiful servant. He was lost, but shall return. Have you heard of him, lad? Have you heard of Sauron? You must have seen it in the skies. His time is near. It is to you and me, lad, to be ready. Wow, this guy.
All the Kool-Aid.
The kids, Theo says, ready for what? And he says, save your strength. You'll need it for what's coming.
Killing the people among them that don't swear fealty. That's what's coming.
Do you think Adar's going to show up at the Watchtower with the orcs, you know, at night and basically say, hey, you know, just show him, like, the army that he has amassed, and it's going to put fear into these men. And maybe he says, you know, hey, leave them, join us and live. Men of the Southlands that still have, you know, that still give fealty to Sauron, and just to kind of like watch those men walk out and join that army. I mean, that would be a huge blow to Bronwyn and Arondir and the rest of the men of the Southlands who are wanting to fight against Sauron.
Absolutely. And I'll be interested to hear if Adar name drops Sauron, because that might shore up what we were discussing earlier, if he's doing it on his own or if he's doing it as a, you know, an agent of Sauron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It could be really cool too, Bride, even though it's like the converse of that is, you know, because Adar is so, he doesn't look as threatening. He is more of like an outlaw. Like maybe he can go there and he'll just go himself and kind of not plead to them like he needs them, but will kind of give a really kind of good point of view. And they're going to be like, oh, they're not all monsters. And this is a lot more approachable than a bunch of orcs and obviously being a pretty damn dirty trick. But I could also see him going in there and charming them a little bit as well.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that could be what we see going forward here. They cut to a scene of an orc reporting to Adar saying that they found it and it's in the tower. And he's talking about Theo's sword. They're going to be on their way and they probably are going to be working double time in the trenches to get there. So, yeah, we can expect to see a big battle coming up. I would expect to see a big battle. I'd be surprised if we don't. I mean, it would just be... I'd be kind of let down if we didn't get to see a big battle. I think it'd be very cool to see these men of the Southlands fight these orcs. I don't see them coming out on top, though. I think they need reinforcements.
Ooh, you gotta imagine once... Oh, sorry.
I was to say, where could an army of reinforcements be coming from?
I don't know, Joe. Where could an army of reinforcements ever be coming from? It seems hopeless.
I got to imagine once per season they're going to have like a big battle set piece. Like it would seem like a waste if they didn't.
I think absolutely. They've shown like Galadriel and some people on multiple people on horseback as well. And kind of that I think were different than some of the flashbacks. So, yeah, I think just even for like a proof of concept for interest for people to return into season two, like they need to kind of show a little bit of they've shown great CG locations and cities, great acting, characters we're familiar with. Hopefully, like I said, they've teased a Balrog, so we'll get some CG monsters. But yeah, a good old fashioned Jackson style battle out on a battlefield would be awesome.
Yeah, man. I hope they've been watching those movies. I hope they also watch Battle of the Bastards and they're like, yeah, you know what? Game of Thrones did it. We could do it too. So I'm really hoping that they'll kind of up the violence as well in those scenes because we have seen this show really get violent. You know, the last episode with the warg and the blood. And then, of course, with Halbrand fighting the men in the alley, breaking bones. I mean, I really want to see, you know, I want to hear swords clashing. I want to see bones breaking. I want to see blood flying, like
maces to faces.
All right, let's jump in to the Galadriel storyline this week, and it starts with a vision, and it's Queen Regent Muriel is having kind of like a dream and welcoming these newborn babies into Numenor. And then she hears like, this sound, this very loud rumble, and the chandelier starts to shake. And we see this gigantic wave in the background and we see it kind of like approaching over the mountains. You start to hear people screaming and it reminded me like of the, You know, you're upsetting the Valar, you're upsetting the gods. And it reminded me of very much like the biblical flood, you know, Noah and the ark and everything. And I just thought that the effects and the dream was very, like, very convincing of like what is to come and like how it is going to wipe these people out.
It's what's crazy and something that always is striking. And I was like talking to you guys this week of going back and reading that fourth book in the Silmarillion and going through it. It's the suddenness of it. You know, their actions, and you could see coming that something bad would happen. And their actions of trying to claim immortality and all these type of things was not going to go well. But it just shows, and the religious allegory cannot be denied, and obviously Tolkien, the devout Christian, it's just that, like, Numenor, and they're all existing at the pleasure of the gods and of and their mercy, and literally you can sink that entire great nation that's lasted for thousands of years and all this history and all these people we know, and in a snap it's literally going to go when they decide it's time to go. And it's just, it is a crazy way to start the episode.
I love the visual of it too, with the white petals falling off that tree and it just blowing into that room that they're in like a snowstorm. So ominous.
Mm-hmm. Now we see Farazan dream over. We get Farazan walking around like the streets and the different vendors that they have there, and then, you know, greeting all the people there, and he gets word of like of a kind of like a mob that is forming, you know, in the yard. And was that his son?
I think that was his son that came and
it
told him.
He called him son, so I didn't know if it, you know, I didn't know if it was just like an elder calling someone younger son, or if that was his actual son. Did we catch his name? I believe it started with a T. We didn't catch his name. No worries.
Is it Treadwell, maybe?
Might be it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, let me go back and, yeah, I have it written here.
Yeah, Joe, so you looked on IMDb. His name is?
Treadwell.
Treadwell.
That's what I'm going with.
Okay. Yeah. So if it's not Treadwell, I hopefully we'll hear about it, but that's what we're going to call him this episode. Yeah. So Treadwell tells him basically about like this mob that's forming in the streets. We get to the mob and it's the man from the last episode that was going after Halbrand, and he's really getting the people riled up and talking about, you know, why hasn't the queen done anything? Why is she allowing an elf in the kingdom? And they start to chant elf lover about Queen Muriel. And Farazan uses the mob to get them behind him. He starts saying that, you know, they are the descendants of Elros, the men that defeated Morgoth. But now one elf threatens us. And he, you know, then gets the crowd really behind him when he says that Numenor will always remain a kingdom of men. And so, yeah, man, I was hating Farazan here so much.
The acting is great, because I agree, you hate him. He's yes. such a prick, but the performance is awesome. And again, you got to remember, in Numenor, he doesn't represent a minority. He really represents what the kind of prevailing thoughts are. But again, taking advantage of those fears, where he kind of in that speeches, you know, it starts with one, they'll come and take all of our jobs and take our kingdom. And it's really sinister, where it's like, they just, one elf just showed up there. She's trying to literally get a boat to leave. And you guys are saying that she's there to take over. And it's just that fear mongering, but it works.
Well, I think what he's doing here is he's kind of being like a delegate and saying like, yes, I hear you. I hear your cries and I am behind you. And I think he's trying to stop them from like basically forming like a mob and maybe a march to like the throne room, an angry mob showing up. I feel like that's the way this could have gone, possibly.
Yeah.
Hmm. I just looked up this character just to be sure, and it's Kemen. So not Treadwell.
I like Treadwell too.
Treadmill or whatever the fuck his name is was apparently one of the people in the tavern.
Wait, Peloton?
Where Arondel went in the first Peloton.
Son of the king.
And then his brother Nordic Track.
He chose a mortal life.
But together they had rock hard abs.
What's his name? Kenan?
Kemen.
Okay. We see that Farazan's son Kemen is flirting with Aarion, who is Elendil's daughter, and he's wanting to. It felt like maybe he was just like, you know, trying to strike up a friendship, but then it seemed more like after inviting her out to get something to eat, he was trying to strike up a like possible relationship. And I think that that's super interesting. Because later on, we do find out that she did go to dinner with him. And I think that that's an interesting dynamic, because you have someone who's basically very close to Farazan, with it being his son, and then someone who's very close to Elendil. And maybe she can get him to kind of feed some information to her that she could, you know, possibly give to Elendil and Isildur. If you see what I'm saying, I just think it's an interesting dynamic to have these two characters possibly starting a relationship, and they're both kind of like on opposite sides of things. Like, one is very...
It could go the other way around as well. Like, true. Farzar could get information from his son.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It could go either way at this point. I just think it's an... I think I like that, kind of like that wrinkle in this story of this new character that was created just for the show of Aerion, that now we've got a character that's possibly striking up a relationship with Farazan's son.
He's got sick game, too. He talked to her very confidently.
Yeah, he did. He didn't even really have to peacock or anything. He was all just like,
excellent idea. I shall let you know if I see
him. Yeah, that was super suave, man.
That was a good line.
Yeah. It worked. She went to dinner with him.
Yeah, it made her laugh. He got the laugh.
Galadriel is presenting Muriel with the scrolls that were brought to her at the Hall of Lore, showing Muriel the contingency plan of Morgoth to have Sauron and the orcs create Mordor. And she tells Queen Muriel that Halbrand is the lost heir in exile to the throne of the Southlands. She says that his people are scattered, leaderless, but with her backing, they might unite. And so she wants Muriel to unite the people of Numenor and the elves to fight the remnants of Sauron and save the men of the Southlands before Sauron takes them as his own. Muriel basically just says, no, not happening. Like, we're going in a different direction. And as Muriel walks away, Galadriel demands to speak with her father, Tar Palantir, the one who has the real authority. And I was just like, oh my God, no tact with Galadriel, right? Like, zero tact at all.
No chill. Galadriel has no chill, no decorum. She is literally the definition of a bull in a china shop.
And I love how they go on to even kind of explain that in this episode. But I loved it to where when Muriel said that they're going in a different direction, and the camera just kind of focuses on Galadriel's face, and you can just see it, like the face acting there. It's like, what was she thinking about in real life where she got that much of a simmering anger look on her face to pull that off? And then she just blows up, and it's like she just does not learn. She just has to immediately take things up to an 11.
She's always stoking the fire. It's like if someone doesn't see things the way that she sees them, and I'm not saying she's wrong here, but I think that she does not, I mean, maybe just, you know, if you want to catch some bees, fucking use some honey. So I think the conversation that she has with Halbrand is very much needed. It's one she's needed to hear for a long time. But she says she wants to speak with someone with the real authority. And Muriel asks what authority she speaks of. And she basically like hers, like believing that she has no authority with the elves. Muriel asks what authority she speaks of hers, talking about Galadriel's authority. She's saying, like, I believe, like, you have no authority yourself with the elves. I don't think that you're here representing Gil-galad. I think that you're just a castaway and you're acting on your own behalf, but basically trying to come off that you have the backing of Gil-galad.
Oh, snap.
Right.
Pretty dead on.
Yeah, I think, yeah. She picked up all the clues there. She's like Nancy Drew.
Yeah, I really like this scene a lot. And I think Galadriel gets a better understanding of how rude she was being in a later scene. I mean, it very much comes to home how rude she was being, demanding to speak to the real authority when she kind of sees what's going on in the first place.
Galadriel pushes the matter and she's thrown into a jail cell next to Halbrand. So they both ended up in a jail cell.
the way they cut that was brilliant too.
Yes.
I mean, it's so funny.
Now we're back at,
he's like, let me guess, tavern brawl. He's so delighted and so not surprised.
No, not at all.
In the cell next to him.
We jump to Isildur, and he's out at sea with the sea guard, and he hears his name whispered. And if I had to guess which direction it was coming from out west. I'm just throwing that out there. But I believe it's probably like we're hearing the voice of his mother here. And I realize that she has passed, but I believe like this is a calling like to him.
That was my thought too.
Yeah.
I jotted that down in my notes, like a sealed ear voice, mother question mark.
I think it is his mother. I mean, she was brought up in this episode, and so yeah. I do think it was her.
Yeah, that was what led me in that direction too, is the altercation that he soon gets into.
Mm-hmm. Well, him and his, you know, two buddies, I mean, one of the guys is being careless and something goes wrong with the sail, and Isildur steps up and says, it was my fault, and all three of them get kicked out of the sea guard. And now we're in an alley with his friends, and they are just pissed off at him for like they get kicked out of the sea guard, and now he's immediately asking them to go out west. They're like,
I mean, they might as well at this point, right?
No, it's like, here's the thing. It's like these guys, like the one guy says, I've been wanting to do this my entire life. And now it's gone. Like, I think maybe, again, another character with zero tact and terrible timing. Maybe you don't ask them immediately after you get kicked out of the Sea Guard to go out west.
Yeah, true enough, true enough. I mean, his other buddy was going to get kicked out regardless, right? He was not doing well.
The sea captain was kind of a dick, though.
I loved that guy, though. I just kept picturing him like saying other things as he's bounding around this ship, because he says everything at high volume and it's all borderline stuff that you'd read on like a guidance counselor's poster on his wall.
I like that.
I just kept thinking like that guy was late for his photo shoot to be on the next romance cover. His friend is just pissed off at Isildur for this happening. And he's like, what have you ever done but brood and blubber about your dead mom? Which, like, that leads to fisticuffs. Understandably, if, like, somebody throws out your dead mom, it's like, yeah, dude, it's time to throw down.
Real world, fantasy world, that them are strong words.
Absolutely. So, yeah, that didn't go over too well. We see that Farazan's son is still kind of talking to Elendil, and so that is, yeah, that's definitely a relationship that I want to keep an eye on in future episodes. I think it will be important. I think we're just kind of like, they're giving us a taste of it, but I think it's going to be very important going forward. And I think that they do need to do something with Eärion, her character. And I think like this is something that they can do with her, is have her strike up like this friendship / relationship with Kamen.
Yeah, a lot of different places that can go, because it's a borderline Romeo and Juliet story. If you think of Farazan as the leader of the Kingsmen and Elendil as the leader of the faithful, then their children getting together, and at least the way they portrayed Kemen so far, he doesn't seem to be like, I mean, it seems like when he's around his dad treats him like shit, and he's carrying that status of it, but he's clearly not impressed by his dad either.
Yeah.
And where Farazan's going, and if they follow, which they're probably not going to really change his ultimate kind of arc, it will really divide that family, and it will lead to some of that family not making it out.
You know,
and that's going to be a really crazy and sad thing to see.
Absolutely. we're back to Galadriel, and she's in her cell. She's talking with Halbrand, and Halbrand tells her that she's been dealing with the situation in Numenor all wrong. She's not dealing with orcs or trolls. She's dealing with men. And you just, you know, the Queen's Court is not her usual battlefield. And he says, you have to find what it is that your opponent fears most. And she immediately says, and exploit it? And he says, no, give them a means of mastering it so that you can master, so that you can master them. And this line, that kind of like is like another nail in the coffin of this guy being Sauron. Like, it sounds like Sauron and the creation of the Rings of Power. He says, find what they fear most. The elves of Eregion created the rings to preserve their lands. So the main power of the rings was to prevent and decelerate decay and change. Then use that to master them. And Sauron's plan was to have Celebrimbor and his smiths created rings for the elves. Sauron forged his own master ring in secret in the fires of Mount Doom. His ring would control the other rings when worn by the elves, making Sauron the most powerful being in Middle-earth. Hmm. Wow. Sure sounds like Sauron here. Like, give them a means. It's like, find what they fear most and give them a means of mastering it so that you can master them. I think it's like, this just sounds like Sauron spelling out his future plan. He's telling what Galadriel, what she needs to do in this instance. But man, everything he's saying here sounds like it's coming out of the mouth of Sauron, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of credence to that, dude. As soon as he said that, and he's basically just giving a TED talk on how to manipulate people, strong Sauron vibes.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the longer this is like, you know, I didn't initially think it was Sauron. I'm still not sold. But the longer they go without kind of clearly introducing somebody else as Sauron, the more and more that's where I'll start to lean, definitely.
I mean, we are through the fourth episode and it's like, where is like Sauron? I think he's been under our nose this entire time, but we shall see. Galadriel realizes what got her thrown in the cell is Muriel's fear of her mentioning that she wanted to speak to her father. And Queen Regent Muriel gives her decision that Galadriel is to be shipped back to the elves by armed escort. Okay, now we are... Okay. Aerion. I'm trying... All these names, guys. Aerion meets with Isildur. And basically says that she went out to dinner, and then Isildur was like, oh, you know, what was his name? And so, yeah, it's kind of confirmed there that she went out to eat with Ken, is it Kemmer?
Kemmen.
And so he tells her that, you know, he was kicked out of the Sea Guard. And at that moment, we get like all these guards that are running around Numenor, and they're searching for an escaped Galadriel. Now, Galadriel has broken into the tower. And then we get our first, not our first shot, but we get... Yeah, is this our first shot of Tar Palantir?
Yes.
Yeah.
He looks like Sleepy Dumbledore.
He sure did. One of the things, when Galadriel was making her way out of that cell, and she was taking on all the guards, and Farazan had pulled his sword, and Halbrand was basically cautioning him or advising him to let her go. And he's like, I can't just let her go. And he's like, you can if you know where she's going. And so this is the first time Halbrand is doing something for Farazan and showing his worth, which pays off clearly, because later on in this story arc, you see Halbrand walking away as a free man.
Wow.
And so I think that because he helped out Farazan there, Farazan sprung him from jail. And I think that we're seeing the start of a relationship between those two, which is something that's going to be very interesting going forward on the whole Halbrand is Sauron front.
Yep.
Wow, Joe, I didn't even pick up on that. Even more Halbrand is Sauron possible proof.
Yeah, dude.
Gonna have to do a t-shirt soon. Halbrand is Sauron.
You better hurry up and make that shirt.
I don't think that we're going to officially find it out until probably the penultimate or the final episode. I think they're going to drag this one out, guys.
No, I agree with that. But if it's going to be this season, I mean, that's still 4 weeks or less. It's not going to be much longer before
I know.
Everyone's going to know what's up.
I know. And we're not really putting out shirts, everybody.
Unless there's a very high demand. We'll start printing now.
Yeah, and then you can wear that shirt, and then when he's not, everybody can, and then you can put that shirt away forever.
I mean, that's kind of awesome. Like, it's like the team that loses the Super Bowl, and they still made all the merchandise, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Collector's items.
Let's see here.
Memorabilia.
Was it revealed or kind of alluded to that Tar Palantir is dying here?
I mean, yeah, he's laying in the bed and coughing and can barely speak and stuff. And Muriel says that not very many people know the extent of his condition, and so she wants to keep it that way.
That's what I thought as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Galadriel says, your father was loyal to talking to Muriel. Your father was loyal to the Elvish ways. Why are you not? And I was like, finally, you know, I mean, you know, that's a great question. That is a great question. And Muriel takes Galadriel to, this is something that I said in the last episode that, you know, one of the gifts that they were giving were given the men of Numenor, they were given seeing stones. And I said to keep an eye out for seeing stones, possibly in future episodes. And here we are, the very next episode, we're getting a seeing stone, and we get the vision. Galadriel puts her hand upon the seeing stone and sees the vision of the end of Numenor, the great wave. And then she finds out that the vision starts with her arrival. And so, because she's like, well, you know, not everything that you see in the seeing stone is concrete. It's, you know, these things can be changed. She's like, oh, well, you know, this one's already started to, you know, the pieces are already falling in motion. It started with you arriving. This is happening.
And in the books, Tar Palantir himself did have some sense of foresight himself, sans the actual seeing stone. So this is definitely something that they've been preparing for. But like I said last week, I liked the acting and the urgency where maybe they thought it came sooner than they thought it would. We weren't ready for this. No, we knew it was coming.
I read this on Den of Geek. They were talking about the wave, and they said Numenor is inspired by the Greek myth of Atlantis. According to Plato, Atlantis was an island city full of brave warriors and ruled by kings, which was destroyed by earthquakes and swallowed up by the sea in one night. A story which may or may not have been inspired by the destruction of the island of Thera, now known as Santorini, centuries earlier. Tolkien had a recurring nightmare about a great wave rising up and covering the land, which he associated with the story of Atlantis. He gave the dream to Faramir in the books, Faramir being a Gondorian and Gondor being one of the realms founded by Numenorean exiles after the destruction of the island. According to Tolkien's timeline provided in Appendix B of The Lord of the Rings, Numenor is destroyed in 3319, the Second Age. In case you're wondering, that's 22 years before the great battle that ends the age. So you might be thinking, oh, okay, we're going to see a series about the last. Okay. No, I think I read all I needed to read there, but yes, there, I found it interesting that Tolkien actually took inspiration from the destruction of Atlantis and then a recurring nightmare that he had.
The recurring nightmare is definitely something they bring up a lot in coverage of the Lord of the Rings. And that's, again, it's really cool to see that it's a direct correlation of a great fear in his, you know, life and his subconscious. That would be the worst way to go and such an overwhelming end. So I just love the connections to his personal life and how he doesn't really try to hide that in his writing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Muriel says that she's going to announce that Galadriel has left and that the crisis is over. And we see Galadriel getting ready to board a ship, and it's on its way to take her back to the elves. And this is when Muriel is walking away and sees the tree blossoms falling. And we hear the voiceover from episode 3. The faithful believes that when the petals from the white tree fall, it is no idle thing. The very tears of the Valar themselves, a living reminder that their eyes and their judgment are upon us. And then we jump to the throne room and we see Muriel talking about, she's like, there is a faithful hour in the destinies of men, an hour of judgment, which each of us, everyone, must decide who we shall be. And she gives this rousing speech and then says that she's going to personally escort Galadriel to Middle-earth. And she's asking for Numenoreans to escort her on her journey there. And then we get a scene of like Numenorean men in like a courtyard, and you know, who will serve, who will join her. Starts off with one of Isildur's buddies that was kicked out of the Sea Guard saying, "I will serve," and then another guy, "I will serve," and then Isildur himself, "I will serve." And then it's like everyone is saying they will serve. And so that is kind of where that story ends this episode. Any final thoughts on the Galadriel storyline?
I was really shocked by the twist at the end of it. The queen or the regent heeded the warning of the leaves, and they turned around and were like, "Okay, yeah, we will send soldiers with you then, because this is clearly sending you off away and not aiding you is not the right course of action here."
I was shocked too, Joe. I was really shocked they were going this way.
But I bet you who's not going to go is Farazan.
Yeah, 0% chance.
He's going to be left on the island with no Muriel there. So he's going to be running things all by himself, and that power is going to run to his head. And who else is on that island that already talks to him? So,
Sauron.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this could be setting up perfectly for the downfall of Numenor that may or may not happen by the end of this season.
Yeah, you're 100% right. It's like, yes, things need, I mean, they definitely need to come to the aid of the men of the Southlands, right? But it's like you're also setting up so much more, leaving Farazan alone with Halbrand.
Exactly. And you know, if you actually went by the lore, when it's written how it's written in Tolkien's writing, it kind of, you could kind of get away with it. It's written much more like a myth, and here's the history, and here's how it went. But if it were to play out exactly how it plays out in the book, I think a lot of people would think it was really stupid, to be honest, in a lot of ways, how it would play out on TV, and it wouldn't seem very believable. Right now, if he is Sauron and things are going the way it's a very believable scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. If we were sticking just to the text, this would all be taking place over hundreds, if not approaching thousands of years.
Yeah.
And with a lot of back and forth, too, with like the Numenoreans being really powerful where they're at on their island, and Sauron being very powerful where he is in Mordor, and then basically having a pissing match about it, to where then Farazan's, or maybe even one of the kings before him, sends an army to the Black Gates, and then Sauron's like, "Oh, I'll go with you." And then he chills there in Numenor, and that's where he starts poisoning the mind of Farazan. And they've accelerated that in a really nice way. I mean, if we're getting there in 4 episodes of this television show already, that's pretty fucking cool.
I'll tell you one thing, Joe. I was not expecting to see those blossoms falling the very
not
next
at
episode.
That rate.
No.
Jeez.
The look that Elendil gives, like the terror, it's like everything you need to know right there.
Mm-hmm. I agree, man. Yeah, this they've definitely compressed the timeline here, and things are moving along. Joe, I wouldn't be surprised if we see the fall of Numenor before the end of this season.
I'm changing.
No, I wouldn't either.
I'm changing my mind. I think it's going to move up faster. I'm thinking next season now, the way it's going, honestly.
At the latest, I would say next season.
At the latest, for end sure.
Of this episode, I'll be on next episode.
With the way it's moving, I mean, it could be the next episode. We don't know.
You see, I'm trying to hold in my head the little bit of lore, but like again, I have to take what I'm seeing on the screen, and there's no way to stretch it out more than another maybe season if they're going to continue to move at this rate, unless they do start to introduce some other storylines that take precedent, maybe. But I just don't see that.
How much of the actual, like, of the flood are we going to see? Are we going to see people like running through the are they going to go there, like people running through the town trying to like get away, trying to go to high places, kids crying, women crying, men fucking like just not, you know, people holding on to stuff, people just, and then an underwater shot of just people floating.
Oh wow,
I saw that elf shot like that already.
I know, so that I mean, that was during the War of Wrath. I mean, but this is, I mean, this hits a little bit closer with it being okay, like with human characters here, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
We are definitely, whether we see the kind of like what you're talking about, Brian, the escape. I do know that a lot of them do go for the mountain on the island because it's the high point, and that kind of obviously makes sense. But I do think whether even it's something sudden, we're definitely going to have a few shots of some characters we know underwater meeting their demise, which is going to be really tough, especially if they do a great job of making us care for these characters like we're starting to.
I think if once the queen or the regents, her like band of ships or whatever that leaves to Middle Earth, if it's 9 ships, I think that's a wrap. I think that because it's 9 ships of the faithful who escaped before. So if Miril and Galadriel's little mini fleet there with Elendil, and we know Elendil and Isildur is among them.
Mm-hmm.
If there's 9 ships, then that's going to line up with the text as well.
But we've got to see, definitely, I think we have to see some scenes of Verizon and of Halbrand kind of, you know, getting closer, and maybe Halbrand taking, you know, getting into his good graces a little bit more and taking over more as like a kind of like an advisor role, honestly.
And Celebrimbor too. Celebrimbor and yes. Sauron have to connect, and that's a real friendship and real. And Celebrimbor is the one who susses Sauron out in the text, so that definitely has to. I would think they need to find a way to get them together sooner than later as well.
Yeah,
and I think he's already talked with Celebrimbor.
I think too.
And
Joe.
That's why that tower is being built and stuff. And then I think he's going to check back in on him later. Maybe we'll even get a flashback from Celebrimbor's point of view where he first met.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
That's what, Joe, I was literally thinking that. No, I was thinking that as I was watching the episode, and I almost brought it up that I feel like, you know, even with just the construction of the Tower Forge in Eregion being built, it leads me to believe that there has to be some sort of a past history with Elrond and Sauron.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't just wake up one day and say, you know what, let me build this forge.
Right.
It has to have been some conversation that prompted. I mean, again, he wants to leave legacy, and he talks about that in his introduction, but there had to have been something that was the little stone to start the avalanche, to use something from the episode.
I mean, I do feel like it goes back to, you know, what Halbrand was saying about, you know, find their fears, give them a way to master it, and then use that to be their master. And I feel like he's kind of like started this plan and put it in place, and the pieces are just moving now. And so we'll see. Let's jump into Elrond and Durin. But Joe, I 100% agree with you there. I really do feel like there has, and I think a flashback, if this is the case, I think a flashback would be well served in a future episode to see those two.
Yeah, absolutely.
We see a shot of, let's get into Elrond and Durin this episode. We see a shot of the construction of the Tower Forge in Eregion. We see elves and dwarves working together to build it. This is where they're going to be creating the 20 rings of power. 3 for the elven kings, worn by Galadriel, Gandalf, and Elrond by the time of the films, the Jackson films. 7 for the dwarf lords. 9 for mortal men, worn by the ring race. And then the one ring made by Sauron himself in Mount Doom. Celebrimbor is talking with Elrond and feels like, you know, like, where's Durin been? Is he avoiding me? Is he hiding something? I want you to go check that out. So Elrond goes to speak with Durin at Khazad Dûm, and he meets with Disa. And she's making excuses for where Durin is. And he kind of calls her out, and she does some quick thinking and then puts him in his place and says, oh, he didn't take his chisel because this kind of ore can be, it has to be pulled from the rock walls. And yes, it may take you a 2-day journey, but for a highly skilled dwarf, it only takes a couple hours. And so, you know, he still knows that she's lying, but he can tell at this point, don't push it. You can see it written all over her face. Like, why are you questioning a dwarf about, like, my integrity, my honesty in my own house? Like,
it's a recipe for strong gravy.
Strong gravy. Yeah, I love that line.
Elrond.
It's a great line.
Elrond goes to look for Durin because he knows something's up, and he finds him in the mines. They end up talking.
I love the way he does it, that he's eavesdropping from a mile away.
Yeah. He's like reading lips, right?
Something like that.
He can hear them and see them. He has like the zoom in and the audio, so both.
He's like, enhance.
Literally. It's like when Legolas let Aragorn lay with his ear on the ground for a long time to then be like, yeah, there's actually this many people
right
coming towards us.
Yeah, exactly. Elrond learns of, Durin tells him about, Mithril. And he won't tell him unless he makes him like a promise. Like, you will not tell anyone about, you know, what you see here. And do we believe Elrond? I mean, he swears on his father, Eärendil.
Yeah, I don't think that Elrond would swear on his father and then cross that.
I agree.
I think that this is like very heartfelt, that he's not going to betray this trust of Durin.
I mean, he's already done things like not visit the guy for 20 years. I mean, like, what? I mean, you do this and you've basically lost not just a friend, but you've lost dwarven allies.
Yeah, they're going to be actively opposed to you.
Agreed. Yeah.
Elrond's going to get caught in the middle here. You can kind of just see that coming. Like, he's not fully filled in. And I think that King Durin's not going to be entirely wrong.
Well, and also we know that one of these rings that Celebrimbor is going to forged, the 3 that he does himself, one of those is forged of Mithril. Yep. So where's he going to get that chunk of Mithril? Either he's going to get a good enough relationship with Durin to get it from him, or Elrond's going to give it to him.
Oh,
and then is that going to have to come with an explanation?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We find out, you know, Durin's talking about Mithril, talking about how it's lighter than silk, stronger than steel, but it's very perilous to mine. And his father has been restricting his efforts to mine for Mithril. And then, yes, he gives Elrond that piece of Mithril and he says, keep it as a token of our friendship. And right after that moment, one of the tunnels, one of the mines collapses. And we learn later, you know, Odysseus talking about it and she's like, you know, Durin was supposed to be in that mine. She's almost, she is thankful that her husband was pulled away by Elrond, who's doing something that he shouldn't be doing. He shouldn't be spying.
Makes her feel terrible for lying too.
Yeah. 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 But we jump into the next scene. It's Deesa singing. She goes full Aretha Franklin and it's awesome. I really feel like it was a beautiful song. I loved everything that was happening in this scene. And we find out that her singing was a plea to the rocks to release the bodies of the men who still had air in their lungs, to release them from the mine shaft. And I thought that this was, I thought it was beautiful.
Absolutely. I was listening to it on Spotify earlier today and, it's so awesome. It reminds me of this one really excellent Prodigy track also.
Just this, this is already on Spotify.
Yeah, dude, you'll have to definitely check it out. I'll send you the link to it. It's the whole album.
So like episode 8 is already on Spotify musically.
Well, basically, it's just a whole album that has Bear McCleary as the artist, and it's just the music of the Rings of Power.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, they're definitely out there, Jake. Like, I was able to even use them on like the Instagram post. Like, they have that music on Instagram.
But if it has music from future episodes, wouldn't that like the titles of some of the songs?
I'm reading the titles right this second.
Interesting.
Wow, the song is called "Sauron is Halbrand."
Wow. Yeah, I was just gonna say. I was just gonna say that. We saw some pieces when she was singing. Did you guys see the pieces of like the grinded up stone and some of that sand start moving? It was almost like it was reacting to her voice and her singing.
Yeah, it was so cool.
And
the opening credits.
Oh, yeah. You know who hates the opening credits more than Jake is Anakin.
Oh, yeah, 1,000%, 1,000%. He didn't even watch after the opening credits. He checked out. I at least watched the episode.
It gets everywhere. We find out Durin pulls all of the men out of the mine. They're all alive. But after this, his father, King Durin, shuts down the whole Mithril digging operation. And Durin is not having it. He is mad at his father and he wishes he could basically just tell him what he thinks. And he yells, "I'll never trade words with the old gods again." And then we get this amazing scene that you guys kind of talked about earlier. I think Durin really connects with Elrond and Elrond connects with Durin here over feeling like they're never good enough when compared to their father. So we've got two sons talking about how difficult, even though one's an elf, one's a dwarf, doesn't matter that they're completely two different races. They can still connect on like not being good enough or not, maybe not even just not being good enough, but maybe just not feeling good enough, feeling as good or just inferior to their fathers. Elrond tells the story of his father. He says, "My father single-handedly sailed to Valin and convinced the Valar to join the war and vanquish Morgoth. So great were his deeds that the Valar lifted him beyond the bounds of this world to forever carry the evening star across the sky. For many years and days, and I would look up to it wondering what might he think if he were watching me. Would he be proud of what I've accomplished with his legacy or disappointed by the countless ways I've failed to live up to it? But then one night it struck me that I would only be too happy to hear any judgment so long as it granted me the opportunity to have one more conversation with my father. Do not waste what time you have left with yours." And I was like, man, that is a good friend.
So that's so beautiful. And like, I can't believe so far the episodes or the moments in the episodes of this show that have like carried the most amount of heart for me is a conversation between Elrond and Durin in that second episode where Durin really lays his heart bare and like yells at him that it's been 20 years. I lived an entire life and you missed it. And now this exchange here, it's just, wow. The writers are doing something really special with this relationship between the elf and the dwarf, which is a fantastic nod to the relationship between an elf and a dwarf that we get in the Peter Jackson films.
Yeah, and I think even in a way, and it's not spoken here, but maybe this is a moment where Durin can understand. It's like saying you missed my whole life, and Maybe now he understands, like, Elrond's just trying to grind away to make his father, the immortal star, proud. And it's like, man, maybe I need to be a little easier on this guy. If I'm feeling pressure from my dad, that's like nothing compared to his.
Yeah, I think it works twofold. You know, it's like, wow, you've had a lot going on in your life too. And I think that all the time that they've spent away from each other, hopefully it's mended now and it's washed over. But it's just nice that these two characters, I think it's very cathartic, like, for them to have this conversation with one another, because I think both of them, like, who else can Elrond really have this conversation with? I mean,
that's true.
Even think about it, because, like, they're both of their fathers are just these living legends. They were living legends. And so it's like, not many people can, like, relate to, like, the legacy that they have to live up to. So, like, I think it's an important relationship. It's an important conversation. And hopefully it's kind of, like, opened up Elrond's eyes as to, like, what an important friendship this should be. Like, this friendship should take precedent in his life. Like, don't let this friendship go to waste.
Oh, absolutely. And I loved, after that incredibly heartfelt moment, it immediately turned into joking and ribbing at each other.
Yeah.
With Disa asking how they first met. And you could tell that Durin had framed this story that he was this brave warrior that saved Elrond, when really it was the other way around. And Elrond saying that he was drawn to the clearing because the screams were so high-pitched he thought it was that of a child.
Yes.
You could tell his wife always thought it was BS, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, he was able to take them down with a bow, and he couldn't take them down with, like, his hammer or his axe. Like...
Durin meets with his father, King Durin, and says that he was proud and stubborn and wrong. And King Durin says that their ancestors believed that when a new dwarf king is crowned, that the wisdom of the past kings flows through him, even their mistakes. And he says, but you need not wait for that day to hear my voice. Forever am I with you, my son, even in anger. And, oh man, what a fucking, it goes from, like, this amazing conversation with Elrond to him being humbled and realizing, like, yes, my father is still here. And I'm going to let my father know the error of my ways and my reactions. And, you know, maybe I am a little too impulsive, and maybe I do need to listen. And then it, like, his father hears this and he's like, you know what? Like, you don't have to wait for, like, the ancestors for me to give you the wisdom and tell you that I'm proud of you. Like, I'm telling you that now. I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, I like how he kind of infers that even when they disagree, that may even make the bond stronger. He may even respect him more when they're not always on the same page.
Yeah.
When Durin, the younger Durin, first walked in that room and started talking and apologizing, and the dad wasn't saying anything for a bit, did anybody else worry that maybe the dad had passed?
I thought he was dead too.
It was too late.
I didn't have that thought. No,
I did. I looked at him and I'm like, dude's not moving. I don't see him breathing.
Yeah, I was like, oh my god, it's gonna crush him if after hearing this, he comes in to find it's too late.
Speech,
yeah.
I was like, oh, that would be heartbreaking. But I mean, it would put him in a position to delve too greedily.
King dying. I thought he was dead, man. I thought he was dead. I was relieved when he wasn't, Joe.
Same.
Dwarves can just be very still.
And he starts to, like, ask his son some questions, and he's just impressed that he can finally talk to his son, and, like, his son's giving him some wise answers, you know, and he's agreeing with him. And he tells his father that Elrond has invited him to go to Linden, and King Durin says that Elrond has been pretty steadfast, that he has no ill intent upon his arrival. And then King Dorne asks him, like, you know, what does his intention tell him? And he says that there's more at work here. And he's like, you know, you're smart to think that. So he's going to go. King Dorne gives him permission to go to Lindon to find out exactly what that is. And that is where our story ended with Elrond and Durin. And I'm telling you, like, yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. I think that the Elrond and Durin stuff, it's stuff like this, like the connection between the elf and the dwarf, the Elrond Durin storyline that really connects me with the Jackson movies, the stuff that I really loved about the Jackson movies. And then just seeing, like, oh my God, just seeing real, like, orcs and prosthetics and stuff. That's another thing that just really fucking works for me in this show. And so I'm really grateful for, like, how much the aesthetic looks and feels like it is from the Jackson movies. So I loved this episode. This is another banger of a fucking episode for me. I'm with you, Joe.
Yeah, dude, this is absolutely Middle Earth for me. I don't see any distinction, and I think they fit together very well so far. And I love everything about this, the costumes, the locations, the cinematography in it, the effects are just glorious. And the music for this is just so good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this had such big shoes to fill coming in after the Peter Jackson movies. And it's done such a good job of shining in its own way in setting its own new path without having to rely on really anything from that. I mean, I thought one of the music was going to be one of the hardest things to do, because the music in those Peter Jackson movies is so iconic to me. Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, I was listening to this on Spotify today, and it's great. It's fucking great. And we're halfway through the season now, and I think the next 4 weeks are going to just fly by, and then it's going to be the long wait till season two. And man, I'm so excited that we're getting several seasons of this, and we know that we're getting them up front, because, you know, I think they're going to continue to be good if this first season's any indication.
Bear McCreary is no slouch when it comes to music. He did the Walking Dead main title theme song, and then he's, you know, done a lot of music for The Walking Dead. Most recently, before this, he had been working with Kevin Smith on the, you know, the He-Man animated series on Netflix. I think that Bear McCreary is just a fantastic guy. I'm glad that they got him to do, like, the music in the main episodes.
I've been a huge fan of his since he did the Battlestar Galactica remake music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's so different than what's going on here. So this guy has just incredible range. I think it's kind of a bummer that he didn't get to cut his teeth on an opening theme song. I know Howard Shore is such a legend, but man, that, you know, for a piece of music that's really only used for a bunch of swirling sand, it's unfortunate that Bear didn't get to do that opening title sequence.
Yeah.
A lot of times that's the most memorable music from a show. Like, people recognize a show from its title music, and it's the one piece Bear didn't get to do.
I'm still holding steadfast that Hal Brand is Sauron, and I am still holding steadfast that Theo will be revealed to be the Witch King. That's where I'm at, guys.
Yeah, nice. I can't argue against it at all.
No.
That is all I have this episode. Any final thoughts? I didn't want to leave anything out, guys.
I think you did a good job. I think it was a great episode, and I think even with the not ton of action, it really is setting up for there to be, like you said, some big set pieces coming forward.
Yeah, definitely talking about it made me appreciate it a lot more than watching it a couple times. Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm just teeth clenched for some of the big happenings that are definitely coming.
Yeah, we're still looking for emails for people. I mean, if you have any theories about the show, please let us know. Send us an email. Is it PCLOTRpod@gmail.com? Please send us an email. We'll read it on the next episode. And then be sure to follow us on Twitter @PCLOTR. and follow us there, and you can talk to us there, interact with us there. And I want to thank all the hosts this week. Jake and I do a show, Pop Culture Leftovers. You can find that on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. We talk about new movies and television shows. We review them and also go over the new news in TV and film. We have a heavy focus on Marvel, DC, and Star Wars. But yeah, join Jake and I on Pop Culture Leftovers. Joe's on Pop Culture Leftovers quite a bit. When you're not on Pop Culture Leftovers, Joe, where can people find you?
Yeah, I also do a podcast called Startcast where I just have guests on and we just talk for a couple hours. Whatever comes up, comes up. Just kind of a long-form conversation type show. And I've also got a book called I Become Death that is available on Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
What is I Become Death about, Joe?
It's like a post-apocalyptic zombie story. A team of zombie hunters is tasked with escorting an assassin through uncleared territory to take out a warlord that is holding a town hostage.
Listen, people, you should be listening to Bear McCreary music and reading I Become Death. I'm telling you. It's the way to do it. yeah, Billy, when you're not on this show, where can people find you and what are you talking about?
So I am the host of a YouTube channel called The Reality Guys. So we cover everything and anything reality television with a nice skew towards comedy and not taking ourselves and the shows too seriously. So we cover anything from The Bachelor franchise, Survivor, Big Brother, Amazing Race, any of the stuff on Netflix like The Circle. Really, The Challenge. If you could think about any kind of mainstream reality TV show, we're out there covering it. So, like I said, The Reality Guys on YouTube and any social media platform.
All right. Awesome. Yes, guys, thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast. That way you can get new episodes dropped in your feed every week. And then if you have some time after that, leave us a review on iTunes. And I just want to thank everybody for listening, and we will see you next week for the Untitled Episode 5. Gotta think we're getting back to the Harfoots next week, guys.
For sure.
I hope so.
Oh, we know you do, Jake.
I love me some Nori.
I'm more of a Pappy fan.
Big, no. Oh, I like them both.
I like them both. I do like them both. All right, guys. We'll check in on Largo's Foot next week. Can't wait. See how Largo's doing. See you then, guys. Later.
Later.
Bye.
Say bye, Billy.
Goodbye.